Spend my dollar.
It's not about what you want. It's about what you're willing to do to get it. Run it again.
Hello and welcome.
I'm not going to, so quit asking.
When you give me a hard time.
For the listeners that didn't get to go.
This is the payback.
Alabama wins!
What you did last year really doesn't matter.
Our goal is to have the kind of team that nobody wants to play.
Hi.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Alabama Football Podcast. Jumping right into this, and Saban was right in his postgame presser. If it stinks, it stinks. If it stinks, it stinks for everyone. The question is this an air freshener kind of stink, or is this a carpet replacement kind of stink? I've experienced both. I had to sell a car once. Don't ask. You know, if we say this sort of less olfactorily offensive, the question really about the Mercer game for Alabama, is this a glass half full or glass half empty type situation? As we roll through this, I'm going to try to be a little bit neutral, but we know that I'll fail in that question. But let's jump in. Let's do this. Before we pick sides of the ball, let's talk about a source of smell that exists on both sides. Leadership. Who are the leaders of the team? Where do the leaders come from? We broke this down in a Zoom call preseason, or actually we broke this down in a preseason show, so everyone has access to it. And I stand by the predictions that we made on that podcast, the individual sort of the narratives, the stories behind each of those individuals. If you haven't heard it, strongly encourage you to go pick that up. That would have been maybe one of the mailbag shows that released late July. Definitely encourage you to check that out if you haven't. We listed quite a number of players, maybe a dozen or more, that we think will evolve into leaders. What we need, however, or what the Alabama team needs, are for leaders to step up and play that role and act in that role, to embrace that role much more aggressively, much more quickly. Now is when we need that to happen. When we think about Saban again and again, and I told you so again, Saban harped on practice patterns last week. And you know, because Saban is layered, you know, kind of like an onion with his messaging, that message, I think, had multiple meanings and multiple targets. Of course, the team and every individual on the team, everyone is accountable for their self development and accountable for themselves. But I think Saban's also with that message, and the repeating of that message is that he is given license to the leaders to speak up. If they're a little apprehensive, a little nervous, Saban's repeated message is really giving them license to step up and really to metaphorically take the team by the short hairs. And I think that happens this week. I think after the Mercer game, going into the Florida game, I think some of these leaders really start to step up and operate and exercise within that leadership capacity. All right, let's jump into the offense, and we're going to hit straight up the offensive line. Last week, I was reluctant to call it an unsettled position. I wanted to say not yet settled as opposed to unsettled, because unsettled has a little more baggage, so to speak. Today, I say the offensive line is unsettled, especially on the right side of the job. I think, bordering on a prediction here, I think Chris Owens is about to lose his starting job at right tackle. And I really hate to say that about Chris Owens. If you watch, and I encourage you to watch the postgame press conference, not only with the coach, but with the players too, you get a real quick sense for why we think Chris Owens is a leader on the team. And he's just a good dude. He's a guy that you want to root for. And so it's against that backdrop that I still predict that he is likely to lose his starting position. One thing that was interesting, maybe a little bit telling, is when the twos came in, when the backups came in, Chris Owens shifted from right tackle to left tackle. And so he got some reps, Chris did, at the left tackle position. And so you think, well, that's interesting. If he were truly entrenched as a starter at the right tackle position, would you want him practicing very much at the left tackle position? And you can make the case, yes, we need someone prepared to back up Evan. So that's a thought. It could be just a preview of what his future role is, the backup there at left tackle. It's interesting now that, you know, Chris has started it, or not started, but certainly practiced significantly and started, if we count last year, at center and now right tackle. And in a game in which he started, he played backup at left tackle. So that's going to be interesting. With the backups, Darian Dalcourt stayed at center, which I think is a demonstration of him being entrenched at the position. He just needs reps. He just needs more time in position. And so we were able to provide more of that for him Saturday against Mercer. Damian George came in with the number twos at right tackle, which was interesting because last week J.C. Latham played the backup position at right tackle. So that was interesting to see sort of the rotation there. Latham did come in with the backups and he played right guard. So something to watch there, how the twos play out. We may actually see, and again, sort of shout out to Kennesaw Caleb, who brought to a Zoom call the idea of Kendall Randolph moving back to right tackle as opposed to the tight end position. And so we may see that next week. It's going to be interesting. There are four names, I think, up in the air for potential reps at the right tackle position. Obviously, Chris Owens could keep it. Damian George, Kendall Randolph, and J.C. Latham could each spend time at that position next week and over subsequent weeks. I think what we do long term, I think there's what do we do for that position Saturday against Florida, and what do we do at that position over the course of the season? I think those might be two answers. Obviously, we want our best case scenario in there for Florida, which may be floor management. And so while I think the growth, not just the incremental sort of how do we marginally improve the position, that may be Kendall or that may be putting Chris back. But the growth, sort of the leap of improvement that we need at the position and on the right side of the line may come with the consequence of lack of experience or youth, sort of a learning curve from a youthful perspective. And so I still am bullish on J.C. Latham ending the season. And that may be something we want to watch for in the Southern Miss game. But against Florida, I think we're much more likely to see Owens or maybe Randolph. Maybe some George, maybe some Damian George. He's at least been in the system a year longer, though he has not seen the field a whole lot in his tenure. That's the offensive line. Bryce Young at the quarterback position, I think, was solid. He was 19 of 27, 227 yards, three touchdowns. That was a nice number. Seven in his first two starts, with that, which I think is impressive. He was hurt by drops, and obviously he's going to be hurt by the offensive line and in their play as well. I think this game sort of encapsulated the concept of the team needs to play better around Bryce. I think Bryce did everything that he could. I think there were drops by the receivers. We'll talk about those. And then we just talked about the offensive line. So I think players need to play better around Bryce. I think Bryce is doing everything that he's being asked to do. He's in a leadership position there at quarterback, but it's also a dependent position. And he needs position groups around him to step into a void, so to speak. Let's talk about the wide receivers, and I'm going to intentionally paint with a broad brush, talk about them as a unit. Saturday against Mercer, the wide receivers just were not dialed in. We know what they can do. We know what they're capable of doing. We saw that, a day, let's say, and we saw that last week against Miami, but they were not dialed in Saturday against Mercer. Jameson Williams, he certainly showed off his speed, but he had drops. He did have a touchdown, but he had penalties as well. And where he shoved the defender who maybe got into him a little bit. Hey, should the defender have done that? No. Should Jameson have responded in that way? Hell no. They always get the what do they say? Someone can shove, but they always get the guy who comes back. They always get the second guy. And Jameson was definitely guilty of that. For my money, I was surprised to see him back in the game so quickly. It could just be a function of his talent, but I was a little bit surprised there. I thought he might sit out a possession, not the game, but I thought he might sit out a position, but he did not. He came back in. I think that speaks to Saban really likes the kid, which is good, and so you let things slide sometimes. But Jameson, I don't think, completely had his head into the game. And so we need to see some improvement there. Again, I think we will. Mechie's a known commodity. I think he's pretty even. He's pretty steady in what he can deliver. And so it was good to see there. I think there were a couple balls that weren't placed right for him. That's a little bit of Bryce. I think that's a little bit of offensive line as well. JoJo Earl looked really good. True freshman getting, he played against Miami, but he got a lot more reps, a lot more opportunity in different positions against Mercer, which was good. He had seven catches for 85 yards, really leading the way both in receptions and yardage across the receiver position. And so think about this, right?
he's going to come in as a freshman, and every game is significant to him because everything is new, everything is learning. He doesn't have the talent drop off sort of enigma that bothers him. He says, this is my first opportunity to play before the home crowd. This is my first opportunity to really get an extended set of plays, an extended role. And so this is all new. I'm going to give it my best because that's really all that I know. And in relative to him playing high school last year, Mercer is a step up in talent, at least a little. And so he didn't have the drop off that maybe some of the others do. But I give JoJo Earl a lot of credit. And I like what we're seeing in him in terms of his emerging talent. Trayshawn Holden, he only had two catches, but really demonstrated some good hands, some good mitts. And so we think about the recruiting class last year and this year. It would be easy to look at Trayshawn as being sort of the second tier amongst those players. But he was on the field quite a bit Saturday. Again, had two catches. Really demonstrated his hands. He's a taller receiver. I think you caught one sort of over a defender, and then one was a catch. We made a couple of moves to get the first down. He's a big-bodied receiver, and I think he's someone that we could really grow to trust, especially going for third down conversions, going for first downs. He's someone that we need to keep an eye on because I think he really has the opportunity to contribute. Jace McClellan and Slade Bolden each had one catch, both for a touchdown. And so I thought it was nice to see them produce, even with only limited grabs. But they were on the field quite a bit as well. Tight ends, I think Alabama was silent in this position relative to the stat sheet. I think Cameron Latu was very solid in blocking and on special teams, which we'll talk to in a minute. He did have an opportunity potentially at the goal line, and it was a play that looked almost exactly like what he did against Miami. We're about 3 to 6 yards off the goal line. He fires out straight, and so all of this is sort of in a limited distance. He fires out straight, takes a quick outside step, and then cuts in for sort of a skinny slant, and he was hit for a touchdown last week, and he was equally as open against Mercer and just Bryce. And again, I think he was getting pressure, and so maybe this was the fault of the offensive line, but as a result of pressure, I don't think Bryce saw him. And so Cam, although he didn't get credit for a touchdown, he did exactly what he needed to do. His execution was equal to that of last week where he scored the touchdown. He just didn't get a ball through to him for him to catch. But what he did is he executed, and he put that on film. And so teams are going to have to recognize, hey, that is something that Alabama consistently does at the goal line. And if I'm a defensive coordinator scheming against Alabama, I don't really care that he didn't get past the ball against Mercer. I care that they're running that play, and he consistently demonstrates that he can get open. And so I need to account for that in my coverage and scheme. And if I put someone there to cover Latu there, then I'm taking that player away from another point of emphasis on the defense. And so I like that Latu demonstrated that. I wish he'd gotten the ball. I like him. I like tight end scoring touchdowns. But nonetheless, I like his performance, which falls off the stat sheets a lot of times. But I liked his performance, and so I want to call him out there. Billingsley played more than he did against Miami, and he played earlier than he played against Miami. And so I'm going to consider that a plus. We didn't do a whole lot designed to the tight end, and I think that's something that I wouldn't be surprised if Saban wants to sort of poke Florida in the ribs using the tight end next week. And so the fact that they were maybe a little bit dormant against Mercer might point to us having something up our sleeves with the tight ends next week. So that'll certainly be interesting to watch. Running backs, I threw this out sort of a throwaway thought last week, and then it has done nothing but intrigue me over the course of the week. What if we rank our running backs, sort of 1 through 3 every week, and then we see what sort of that trend line starts to look like? And so I've sort of been fascinated by that idea. And so watching the primary running backs, the primary three, we'll get Roydell in there, but he's not there yet. If we start thinking about the top three running backs, and this is one of those situations, but there's three of them, so someone has to be one and someone has to be three.
But it's not a function of I like the one and don't like the three. I like all of the guys. This is just how I'm ranking them based on their performance. And I think that with extended production or extended opportunities, even if they play for another school, I think all these guys are ones. So let's be very clear on that. So I think in order, I would put Brian Robinson. I thought he had the best performance of the running backs. He had 10 carries for 70 yards and a touchdown. I think if he had 20, 25 carries, he would have gone well over 100 yards. He is a physical runner, and a physical runner is going to get even more physical as the game goes on because the defense is going to be worn down. I think if he had gotten, and you could do easy math. If he was averaging, 70 yards on 10 carries and he gets 20 carries, so that's 140. But, sometimes averages don't hold out. I legit think he could have gone for 150 or more yards, maybe a couple of three touchdowns. I think he would have gotten stronger as the game went on, and I think he would have broken a really nice run at some point. But I think performance on the field, I think he was our best-looking running back Saturday. I think Jace McClellan, his average was a lot lower. He was four carries for 13 yards. He did have a touchdown, but he was used in the passing game more so than the other backs. He had one catch for 21 yards. So down the field a little bit of running, and he scored a touchdown as well. So I think the diversity of his performance as well as his production buoyed him into the second spot. And Trey Sanders, I put him in the third spot, and it's largely a function of his production. He was seven carries for 30 yards. I'm going to say this about Trey, though, and he got sort of rolled up in the backfield a couple of times. The only time that not counting sacks, right? Let's get back to the offensive line. The only times that were really sort of lost yardage handing to a running back, it was Trey Sanders. And I think he was more victim of the situation than guilty of not, being an effective runner. When he got to the edge, he looked more fluid than any of the other running backs. He looked more polished. He looked more upside potential than the other two backs. And so if you rank them based on their performance, their production Saturday, then I have to put Trey in third spot. If you rank them across what could you envision them doing, I have a hard time not putting Trey at the top of that list. And so that'll be interesting to see how sort of those plot lines, converge or diverge as the season goes on. So overall, offensive side of the ball, 24 first half points is not bad, although Alabama left a lot on the table. There were four stalled drives, two with penalties and two with drops. I think those are correctable, but they're also the types of errors that can cost you a game. And so Saban is right. We need to get this ironed down or we can drop games. When we go mini game ball on offense, I'm going to go Trayshon Holden for all the reasons that we talked about. He truly was, I thought, epitomized the mini game ball. He's not going to get headlines for what he did, but what he did with a couple of key possessions, helping move the chains. We talk about stalling drives. He helped keep drives alive and really demonstrated a lot of confidence and poise and really good hands. And so what we saw him deliver translates, I think, into future weeks, I think in potentially really, really exciting ways. All right, now let's flip the field to defense, and I'm going to use three words to just summarize the experience watching the defense, Alabama's defense on Saturday. One, I was pleased. Two, I was nervous. And three, I was annoyed. I was pleased with the first half shutout, holding Mercer to 52 yards in the first half. In 3 of 12 on third down conversions overall. I know there's a talent differential, but I think Mercer ran for 8,000 yards last week against Point, and they scored 69 points. And so the fact that they were shut out in the first half and held only to 52 yards, I think, is a credit to Alabama's defense. I was nervous. What made me nervous? Will Anderson made me nervous, and that cheap block that was placed on Will Anderson that knocked him out of the game, knocked him to the locker room, and knocked him into questionable status for the Florida game. If there is good news, is that he is not injured for the season. He's questionable for Florida, but he will return. It's just a matter of when and how quickly. But still, that's definitely something. And we'll unpack that a little more in a moment. But certainly that left sort of a sour taste as the game ended. I didn't like the final score, but I really didn't like Will Anderson being hurt. And so watching games the rest of the evening, my mind kept going back to Will Anderson, Will Anderson, Will Anderson. So still remain nervous today, Monday, when recording this on Sunday. It probably won't drop until Monday or Tuesday. And so we'll know more by the time you're listening to me say these words. But nonetheless, a little nervous about Will there. And then annoyed. What with the secondary. Definitely annoyed about the secondary. And so let's talk about that, because I actually think I have an answer. I think I know what the what is now that I've given some additional thought. So let's talk about the secondary. Marcus Banks and Kool-Aid McKinstry made their first career starts and their first career interceptions against Mercer on Saturday, which is pretty incredible when you consider Alabama played a team that doesn't pass the ball a whole lot, that both of the starting corners in their first starting experience were beneficiaries of interceptions. So that was definitely good. If we want to say something that annoyed me a little bit, even more specifically with the secondary, and I'm going to say this like I'm entitled, but what's going on with Josh Jobe and Jalen Amar Davis? You know, these mysterious minor injuries that kept them out of practice. Of course, Saban gets to run his ship as he pleases, and I give him full rein to do that. At the same time, hey, what's happening here? There was not a single article. There was not a single reference to those. And look, had it been referenced, they would have been in a dozen articles, because that's what articles are a writer's interpretation of what they hear in pressers for the most part, especially sort of the beat reporters, so to speak. And that's not negative. That's not bad. It's just the nature of it. And if you listen to press conferences and read enough articles, you sort of get that's the flow. That's the rhythm. And so there was nothing to read because there was nothing to said about it. And the media is very limited in what they get to see and hear from practices. And so Jobe and Jalen missing practice for minor injuries. I think this also speaks to maybe a softening of Saban. I think in years past, they would have played through. And we've all heard, you know, coaches or media talk about, you know, Coach Saban sort of grinding every ounce of production out of his players to the extent that, you know, you don't leave Alabama and not need surgery, those types of comments. And so I think sort of an older school Saban would have said, rub some dirt on it and keep playing. And this version of Saban says, I'm going to need you guys more in the future than I need you now, so let's rest you up. And so I think that's net good, but it was interesting. It was interesting to see that. The safety positions, I think, a little bit unsettled. Now, here I do think unsettled is too strong, especially as we sort of walk through some additional thoughts that I have. But everyone seemed healthy. Everyone seemed on the field in different capacities. So Jordan Battle was there. DeMarco Helms was back from injury. It was good to see him back. He's wearing a different number. He's wearing number 2. And so my first thought was, what's PS2 doing back there? Where's Patrick Surtain, number 2 last year? But, that's Helms. He wore 29 last year. Brian Branch was there. Malachi Moore. And then Daniel Wright. And we all saw Daniel Wright, number 3. If we watch the games, there were 2 busts in the secondary that led to touchdowns. And it's very easy to get mad at Daniel Wright for those 2 busts. I think I think we sort of knew that he was the one out of place. And at first, one of them looked like McKinstry. And then Saban, I think, corrected everyone's collective opinion on that with his conversation, if you will, with Daniel Wright. And so it's easy to say, man, those 2 busts and Daniel Wright. But I think there's more to it. There's more to it than that. And so I have a theory on these busts. And so let me roll this out, sort of my thinking here. My first thought was the corners, we're playing backup corners, not the starting corners. These are backup corners. And so maybe that contributes to some miscommunication across the unit. And I thought, well, that's a pretty good idea, but that's not it. I don't think that's the answer. Maybe contributed a little bit, but that's not the answer. And then I thought, well, you know, DeMarco Helms was back and he missed a lot of time in camp, practice, as well as didn't play against Miami. So maybe him being out contributed to the confusion and the miscommunication. And I thought, well, no, that's not it. I don't think that's it. That doesn't resonate with me as the answer. Could it be a contributing factor? Sure. Is it the reason? No, it's not the reason. That does not sit well with me. That does not resonate with the reason. And then it dawned on me. I know why. Think about Alabama's secondary. Think about Alabama's defense. Alabama plays from a base nickel. We call it the base nickel on the podcast. Saban will talk about base or regular defense as being four defensive backs, but Saban will kind of kid. We mostly play nickel, and so that's kind of our base. And we said that on the podcast for years that we run a more of a base nickel than a base four defensive back. So we base with five defensive backs, and then if we make a shift in DB count, it's typically to go to six. So to a dime. Long yardage situations, passing teams, whatever it is. And so typically, and I've not run the analytics over this, but I'd be pretty safe in saying that 90% of the time, perhaps better than 90% of the time, Alabama's playing defense with five or six defensive backs on the field. Alabama will go to a regular or a four defensive back against a very clear running situation, a goal line situation where there's just limited real estate, or a short, a third and short with a critical first down where a team is most likely going to do something in a confined space, then we might go four defensive backs. Rarely, almost never, do we play material snaps in a game with only four defensive backs. But wait, against Mercer, we did. I counted the DBs multiple times throughout the game, especially early to get a sense for what we were going to do. And there you were, four defensive backs. And so if your muscle memory playing the safety position, if your muscle memory from all of your practices, from all of your games, from all of your snaps, maybe hundreds of plays, multiple hundreds of plays, maybe better than 1,000 plays, practice, and game, you have help over the top, then you're going to play Mercer and just intuitively think you have help over the top because that's the world you live in. And against Mercer, where we were playing four defensive backs instead of five or six, there just literally was not another defensive back on the field. Now, that's not an excuse, but it is an explanation for why we saw two busts with otherwise veteran players. So I think that's something to watch. That intrigued me. I think there's some component there, and I wish I would have an opportunity to ask that as a press conference question, this week, because I do think there's a little bit of rational explanation there. Anyways, I wanted to share that thought with you. I promise, and I say these things, and they sound boastful, and I hope that they don't, but I read 15 pages of, just chat room stuff. No one mentioned it, and I probably read 30 articles this morning, and no one mentioned it. I listened to a couple of press conferences. No one mentioned it, but I think there's teeth to that. I think there's a certain logic to that approach, and so that's sort of a fun theory there. So we'll see how that plays out. Any more busts like that, especially in a regular defense, which we won't play a lot of, and then maybe that comes up in a press conference, and we can see how we measure up on that one. All right, let's run through some other things on defense. Drew Sanders, I thought, played well in his first start for Chris Allen, who was lost for the season last year. He had two tackles and two pass deflections. Those aren't big numbers, but let's say that again, two pass deflections. And so Drew Sanders, I think it's sort of well known, his strength is going to be at the line of scrimmage, stuffing the run. And so the fact that he went out in coverage, batted a couple balls, I thought was telling. We definitely saw him out in coverage a little bit. We kidded about that with Will Anderson last week, but Drew Sanders did that Saturday against Mercer, which is interesting. One of his pass deflections led to an interception that Kool-Aid picked up. So Drew Sanders definitely productive there. Chris Braswell, I thought, was good in relief for Will Anderson. He's not nearly as big, and I don't think nearly as physical. I think he's more of a pure pass rusher, whereas Will Anderson has grown into more of a multifaceted player. But Chris had, Braswell had three tackles. Dallas Turner contributed three tackles as well. And then King Makuta in the rotation, he had a tackle for loss. And then I start thinking on another sort of topic. How do we replace Will Anderson? Now, hopefully Will's able to come back and give it a go and give us some reps. I mean, hopefully he's able to come back and be full health, but let's have, you know, sort of a what if, and let's also be a little bit realistic. If he comes back, he's probably not full strength and he probably is on a limited snap count. And so what do we do to sort of backfill at the position? And I think we do multiple things. Replacing someone of Will Anderson's talent, you know, it takes a village, right? And so I think we'll see a little bit of Sanders and Braswell bookends. So we'll see that serve the need. I think it's all about getting your best players on the field where they can contribute. And that sometimes is an independent effort than what the true just straight up depth chart says. So when we think about it with that sort of philosophy, I think we might see Christian Harris play some outside linebacker as opposed to the middle linebacker position. I think, and then in the middle, you have Tua Toa, which we know Hank, right? We know what he's capable of. And Jalen Moody has been playing so darn well at that middle linebacker position. And so if you had a defense that had Tua Toa, Jalen Moody, and Christian Harris, all three on the field at once, I think Christian Harris is sort of the top end athletically dynamic of those guys. And he could step in and play that outside linebacker position for Will Anderson. Maybe not the whole game, but maybe it's 10 or 12 snaps where we're rotating in multiple solutions to give Florida different things, things they've not seen before, but opportunities for us to solve for the Will Anderson missing puzzle piece. I would not at all be surprised to see Christian Harris out there. Again, that has a lot to do with Jalen Moody playing just so darn well. And so Christian Harris at that position. And so I got ahead of myself in my notes. LeBryan Ray, I think, could also spend some reps at that position in more of a pure defensive end. So think about three down linemen, and then we bracket those three down linemen with outside linebackers. Well, if we said not so much a four-man front, although we could do that as well, but what if we said, look, we use this sort of hybrid linebacker with Will Anderson, and we let him do other things. What if we're going to define that role to more specifically just be a defensive end? Then LeBryan Ray, especially in sort of known run situations, we put LeBryan Ray in as a sort of a more of a defensive end as opposed to a hybrid outside linebacker. And I think that we could sneak in, you know, 5 or 8 snaps there as well. So that might be something to look at. So I think when we go to see on the field, how do we solve for a missing Will Anderson? I think even if Will Anderson comes back and is on a pitch count, I think we've got layers of what we could do. Straight up Braswell, something with Christian Harris, and potentially something even with a LeBryan Ray. Now, LeBryan Ray himself is coming back from injury, and it was said that he was ready to go for the Miami game, and he didn't play against Miami, and he did not play against Mercer. And so if we think of sort of a convergence of circumstance, LeBryan Ray has a significant amount of upside potential, just his athleticism. And so maybe we're kind of, and he's been a little bit injury prone and he's coming back from injury. So we may say, look, LeBryan Ray, we're going to sort of set you on the shelf and we're going to bring you in for critical situations, critical reps in critical games. Well, Florida's already going to be that. You know, Texas A&M is going to be that. Ole Miss might be that. Later in the season, it might be an LSU. And so we're going to manage your snap count, even just by managing the games that you play in. And so Florida, he was already probably going to get some reps. And now he may have even more of a specific sort of designated opportunity to support the team. And so that would be a nice storybook event for him to come in and play well in those situations. We'll see how that plays out. Other players, Tua Toa, I think, looked great. He had 6 tackles. Even with his injury, we remember he went out of the Miami game with an elbow injury. Well, he was wearing a brace, and it looked like it did not impact him at all. There was certainly, like I said, 6 tackles, but he met the ball carrier in the hole at the line of scrimmage. And you know, you go in and you wrap with both arms, and depending upon if the running back is on your right or left side, you're more leaning with that shoulder and that arm. And so his injury is on his right elbow. And like I said, he's got it all bandaged up. And he met the ball carrier head on with his right
his right shoulder and his right arm. And so he led with the injured arm. We've seen players, linebackers, it happens a lot with linebackers. We've seen linebackers where they have an injured arm and they're almost a one-armed player, which is better than Marcus Carter, but he's almost like a one-armed player, and they're trying to shield or protect and hit with one side of their body to protect their other. Not Hank. And it could be just pain management tolerance. It could be that, you know, it didn't hurt as bad as it looked, you know, a week later. Could just be that he's a tough SOB, but he stepped into that hole and led with his injured arm. And I thought that was impressive. I almost expected to see, hey, what is his wince level when he gets up? Does he wince? Does he hold his arm? Does he need to go out? Nah, you wouldn't know. If you didn't know he'd been injured, you wouldn't have known that he was injured. Brian Young across the defensive front, I thought he was very active across the DL. He really stepped up, 4 tackles, a sack, 2 TFLs. He's a big old boy, and he's a guy that when we think about the depth of the defensive line, I kind of had him on the fringe of that rotation, and I think Saturday he stood up and said, hey, you guys at that podcast, whatever you guys are thinking, you need to jack me up that list. And we certainly recognize that and salute Byron Young in that regard. Phil Mathis, I thought, was very active. He had a sack. DJ Dale looked good. He had a sack as well, which is rare for the nose tackle position. And you could argue maybe a little bit rare for DJ Dale as well. I liked DJ Dale in the postgame press conference. He just looks like a tough, menacing guy. And I've liked his performance. I've been bullish on him coming back from injury. And I thought he has looked I thought he's looked good this year. Tim Smith is more of a fan favorite at that position. And I'd like to see Tim get some more reps, even though I know it comes at the expense of DJ. I like the versatility there. And Tim Smith really looked good. And then Daniel Wright, I think his brother, Major Wright, played at Florida. And so I know Daniel really is going to want to play in this game. And I have sort of been bullish on him. Daniel Wright's the guy. Some of you remember a couple years ago, I sort of ran into someone at a restaurant that actually works in the football facility. And we just had a conversation, and I started throwing out a couple player names, and Daniel Wright had started that game, which was a little bit of a surprise because he wasn't a starter. And so we talked about, you know, his getting an opportunity, and, you know, everybody likes Daniel Wright. Daniel Wright is an incredibly athletic player. He just doesn't, you know, he plays at one speed, which is full speed. He doesn't always play patient, and he maybe doesn't know all the nuance of the playbook. And I thought, well, you know, he's a sophomore. That's what, you know, that's what your sophomore year is for, whether you play football or not. And so I was bullish on him being a better contributor last year. And he was in spots and not in others. He was sort of a boom or bust player. And I thought, man, this season, he's going to really surprise everyone and just pull it all together with this extra year that he has, that he decided to come back. He's really going to pull it all together. And I still hope and think that could happen. Just I'm letting go the strength of the grip that I have on that idea. And Saturday was part of that. And so it pains me a little bit to say that we might not see Daniel Wright outside of special teams against Florida. At the same time, you know, maybe it doesn't pain me, we'll see how that plays out. I think we're going to see him less in the rotation. I think that's just going to be a truth of the matter with DeMarco Hellams back and then the emergence of Brian Branch, you know, the emergence of McKinstry, right? There's a lot of different names and players that we could start to roll in as different puzzle pieces. So that'll be something to watch. And unfortunately, I think Daniel Wright may see his opportunity to participate sort of diminish. We'll see how that goes. Mini game ball. I got through this. I did mention his name, but in a little bit of a different capacity. But I'm going to go mini game ball to Christian Harris. I think as quietly as possible, he led the team in tackles. He had 8 tackles with a TFL. He just seemed to play natural, very comfortable, and was making plays sort of sideline to sideline or end of line of scrimmage to end of line of scrimmage. Number 8 in the Alabama defense just seemed to be in every screen, every shot. He was there. And so I think that's a player that I don't think he made like a headline play necessarily, but he made a lot of plays that contributed to the overall success of the defense.
All right. We'll switch it up and go to special teams. Just there's a lot of special teams things to sort of reference and call out. And so I've got a list of them here that I bulleted. And so let's take a look at those. Anytime your special teams units block a punt and score a touchdown, that's a good day for special teams. And so we definitely saw early in the game, Alabama defense, really our offense, really struggling. So Chris Braswell blocks a punt, just goes completely unblocked. They've got the three sort of protectors, and the one on the end just sort of barely sort of half-ass sticks his elbow out. Like, that's going to block Chris Braswell. And I'm thinking, what the hell else are you on the field to do but block a guy that's running straight at the punter? I do not understand that. If there had been someone coming to the inside, then you let the outside go to protect the inside. But he wasn't. He was more focused on his job was to run down the field and cover. He was more concerned with covering the punt than he was blocking so that there could even be a punt. Oh, if I was a special teams coach at Mercer, I would be so aggravated with that play. But nonetheless, Braswell made an outstanding block there, batted the ball. Jace McClellan was able to scoop and score. And so that was certainly fun to watch. Cameron Latu, I promised that we'd mention him on special teams a couple of times. He fielded squib kicks from Mercer, and I thought he handled those very, very cleanly. The second one, it was interesting. Saban had not words, like he was angry, but he had something to say to Cameron about that. And, you know, and Saban's never going to miss an opportunity to coach, or, hey, you did it this way. It could be a little, you know, this way, you know, whatever it was. He was offered a little bit of coaching there. It's only going to make Cameron a better player. But nonetheless, what Cameron did on those two plays was textbook right. Well, I mean, Saban had an appendix he wanted to add. But from my lines, you know, from my seat in my recliner, I thought Cameron played both of those plays well. I certainly possessed the ball, which is the intent of the return team. And those little squib kicks are designed to sort of throw off the pattern, you know, maybe get a turnover there. And so I thought Cameron did very well in that regard. James Burnup, the Aussie kicker, I thought he acquitted himself. He had three punts, which, damn it, three punts. I didn't want to see any Alabama punts on Saturday and have to endure three of them. Ugh. But Burnup averaged 43 fields. Saban said it in his presser, we flipped the field a couple times, so you got to like that about special teams. And so I certainly enjoyed that. JoJo Earl returning punts. You know, Saban was very clear, and he said, look, we know what we get from Slade back there, which is very good stuff, and it's what we want. But JoJo has just the opportunity to be dynamic. So the compare and contrast that Saban offered there, he has said, Saban has said so many good things about JoJo Earl that I think we're going to see an increased role, an increased opportunity. We talked about straight up on offense, he led all receivers with catches and yards, and then he led all punt returners with catches and yards as well. We had two. He had 45 net yards. He had a 29-yarder and a 16-yarder. And so I think this remains a platoon or a platoon at the position. It's everything is about possess the ball. And I think he wants to bring along JoJo a little bit slow, but he still wants to give Slade some reps back there as well. And I think that's going to make Slade work a little harder at that position. Not that he's not already a hard worker, but he's going to continue to work hard there. And I think his effort in his working with JoJo, I think it's just going to net that both of them will benefit from that experience. And so excited to see how that plays out. Will Reichert, you know, the headline is going to be that he missed a kick, and it's going to be such a disproportional negative because, you know, frankly, it's his first miss after, you know, 19 makes. It's his first miss since what, 2019? And so, but it's a single miss. And it was whatever the distance was. But he did have two field goal makes, and he had six PAT makes. And so Will had a very, very productive day. He is an outstanding kicker. And so it will be annoying to see the articles and everything said about the miss because it'll be sort of inflated. But that's the nature of it. Every sort of outlet is going to have their version of that story. But nonetheless, there you go. All right. So let's flip to next. Florida in Gainesville. And so again, you know, Saban is, you know, Saban said it in his post-game press conference or his post-game interview with Cole Kubik on the sideline, and he had sort of that wry grin or smile that Saban has, and again, we see more of that now than we used to. But you know, Saban made it very clear he's getting ready for next week. You know that basically, you know, players, if you know, they're going to have to shake themselves or they're going to be shook. And I thought that was an interesting comment, and he's exactly right. This is a team that the preparation is going to have to be all in. It's going to have to be invested. It's not going to be sort of a half baked. Jess Nichols over at TideFans.com had a really nice article, and his headline said that's when I read his headline, you know, half baked effort. I was like, well, that's exactly right. That's exactly the right expression for what we saw here. And you know, Saban had been preaching that all week. And so Florida is not going to need a half-baked effort. It's going to need a full five-star effort. And so hopefully this week we see that. We hear report of that. Saban sees that, and the team delivers that. When we think about the game, and there's some level as a fan, there's some level of assumption that that's going to be the case. And not to overly simplify, but I think that's appropriate. I think that's right, that the team will be more juiced for Florida than they were for Mercer, right? I mean, come on. So when we think about Florida, I think the matchups in this game are really going to be critical. Now, I'll cop to, you know, Sunday afternoon. I've not yet done all of my homework on Florida, but that's coming. If we think about Florida, but I still think the matchups are critical. When we think about Florida with Dan Mullen teams, you know, they're typically pretty solid on offense. I think Alabama matches well. Alabama's strength is the defense. And so if Florida's going to be stronger on offense and Alabama right now is stronger on defense, and I think that's a good matchup. And I like Alabama in that regard, even if Will Anderson is out or limited. I think Alabama can still be very strong on defense. And so I like that matchup. Florida has lost players on defense. Now, all the talk is about the players that lost on offense, but they lost players on defense as well. I think across the defensive line, they have a couple Auburn transfers. And that's, you know, we can read between the lines there. That weakens Auburn, certainly. But I don't know that we've had problems with Auburn's defensive line the last couple of years. And so that's what Florida has sort of replaced their players last year. And they had a couple guys last year that I thought were very, very good. And so if they're replaced with Auburn defensive lines that maybe players that we weren't necessarily as concerned about, then maybe that plays to our favor. And, you know, I think Alabama, while not as proven on offense, certainly compared to 2020, I think it's easier. I think that's easier to address in game planning than gaps in defense, because sometimes that's just talent. That's just talent that's not available to you, to the coaching staff. Whereas in offense, you have the opportunity to scheme a little bit more than you do on defense. And so we'll see how that plays out. We saw a well-schemed Alabama play against Miami. And so we'll see how that plays out against Florida. I think the matchups both sort of tilt in the way of Alabama. So we'll see how that goes. Again, if I were projecting right now today, I would call it kind of a 27-20 style game with Alabama winning the game. We do have an interview with Florida podcast that we're recording hopefully on Monday. And so that'll come out and we'll get some additional insight to Florida and see what we think about how that team matches up. And then we'll get together with the Zoom call on Saturday and we'll unpack Florida in a lot more detail in the Zoom call. And we'll run through predictions there as well. If you're not getting the invitations to the Zoom calls in your email box, then it's because you're not a member yet of our support program. And so if you want to listen to the Zoom calls, if you want to participate in the Zoom calls, hit the website, hit me an email or hit the website, alabamafootballpodcast.com or @gmail.com. And we'll get the information you need to make that happen. Speaking of predictions, Chris was closest last week with his Mercer prediction. He went 51-10. That's the most points that any of us predicted that Mercer would have. And that was closest to the 48 prediction that Alabama had. So Chris wins the sort of the pick contest. Not that there's a prize other than just you know that you guessed it right. All right. So that's what we have for today's show. Drop us an email, leave us a review. We appreciate you listening. We absolutely 100% do. And we hope you'll give us a ride on the Zoom calls. You can join for a month for $2. And for $2, you can download everything that we have and then join a month's worth of Zoom calls and really just test drive the entire bonus structure program for $2. It's the best deal we can offer because we want to get more people engaged and involved in that, because we think it's a really good program, a really good sort of level of access, if you will, and a way to engage and participate with us. And it's just so much damn fun that we think for $2 you'll agree and you'll join and support us for longer. So with that, this has been another edition of the Alabama Football Podcast. Roll Tide.
Thanks for listening to the Alabama Football Podcast. We love that you're tuned in and hope that you enjoyed the show. We encourage you to reach out and let us know what you like, where we can improve, or just to shout out a Roll Tide. We are where you are. iTunes, Facebook, Twitter, email newsletters, t-shirts, free roster downloads, and of course, on the web at alabamafootballpodcast.com. Check us out where you'll find easy links to your favorite way to follow the Tide. Got that, Coach?
Aye.
Of course. Roll Tide.